Guys, welcome back to another episode. This is episode 10, Beyond 2020. I'm Akshara.
And I'm your co-host, Atharva Anand. Y-Cult's Real Talk is a podcast with a series of interviews with physicians. Our mission is to make medicine and healthcare relatable for teens and young adults by diving into real-world problems, debunking myths, and sharing inspiring stories with medical professionals. Through fun and engaging conversations, we aim to spread awareness and inspire the next generation to explore healthcare and make informed decisions.
Our eyes are one of the most powerful and complex organs in a human body. They allow us to perceive the world, navigate our surroundings, and connect with others. But what happens when our vision is compromised? Today, we'll explore the fascinating field of ophthalmology, the branch of medicine that specializes in eye care, vision correction, and intricate surgeries that can restore sight. From diagnosing common conditions to performing life-changing surgeries, ophthalmologists play a crucial role in healthcare. To help us with this episode, we have invited Dr. Carlos Gonzalez.
Dr. Gonzalez is a board-certified ophthalmologist with over 42 years of clinical experience, specializing in pediatric ophthalmology with a focus on conditions such as strabismus, amblyopia, and exotropia. He earned an undergraduate degree from Stanford University, completed medical training at the University of Utah School of Medicine, and went on to pursue residency and a fellowship in pediatric ophthalmology at the University of Texas Health Science Center at Houston. Thank you so much for joining us today. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Great.
I cannot wait to explore the delicate and high-stakes world of eye care and surgery, where precision meets innovation. So sit back and relax.
First, to understand the science behind sight and about an organ which is complex next to the brain, Dr. Gonzalez, can you please explain how the human eye works and how it makes the eye so complex?
Well, thanks for having me, guys. It's a pleasure to be able to help you with this podcast, and I think it's a noble effort. Just basically, the eye is essentially a very complex camera. It has a system of lenses or structures that act like lenses that allow the image or light that enters the eye to be focused on the retina. The retina detects the light image and transforms it into electrical impulses that get transferred via the optic nerve to the brain, where then the brain transforms that into an image. Okay. The light images that enters the retina. Now, most people don't realize that most of the focusing power, the A refraction of the image or light that enters the eye is actually provided by the cornea, which the cornea is a clear kind of window of the eye. Most people believe that the lens is the primary focusing power of the eye, but most of the refraction or the bending of the light image that comes into the eye is performed by the cornea. The retina is responsible for absorbing the light, and through a system of interaction between cells and nerve endings, takes that light energy and feeds those signals to the optic nerve and then on to the back of the brain, to the occipital lobe.
Wonderful. So, what are the most common eye problems and why do they occur?
The most common eye problems. Eye infections, the pink eye or conjunctivitis as we know it, things like allergies, allergic conjunctivitis, your people will injure the eye, corneal abrasions, styes. Those are probably the most common, just run-of-the-mill eye problems. But the main reason people come to ophthalmologists in general is for simple things like blurred vision. And of course, many things can cause blurred vision, from simple dry eyes or need for glasses like nearsightedness or farsightedness. There's things that can affect their lens, like cataracts. There's other things, retinal diseases that can cause changes in your vision. But the most common things, like I said, they're generally blurred vision and eye infections.
And would those be the same eye problems which people would typically see an ophthalmic surgeon?
Okay, so yeah, so ophthalmologists are trained in ocular surgery, which is a distinction between ophthalmologists and optometrists, even though most recently a lot of optometry training programs are starting to include introduce basic surgical techniques, but the main difference is that ophthalmologists are trained in ocular surgery. So the type of ocular surgery that you perform is based on the specialty in, or subspecialty in ophthalmology you choose to train in. Because you have refractive surgeons. You have general ophthalmologists, for the most part, are trained to do pretty much every, when you train as a resident, you're exposed to all types of ocular surgeries, from refractive surgeries, including cataract surgery, exposed to retinal surgeries, strabismus surgeries, orbital surgeries. So you get a experience in essentially all the subspecialties of ophthalmology. And then if you choose to train or do a fellowship and extend your training in subspecialty areas like cornea, refractive surgery, retinal surgery, pediatric surgery. And that's what determines essentially the things that people come in to see you for. In my case, in children, other than routine eye exams or kids who are having difficulty seeing or their eyes are misaligned, are probably the most common reasons that people would come in to see me. Aside from the normal, I mean, the more common things, like I said, like the infections, eye injuries.
Great. So does aging impact eyesight and can it be slowed?
Yeah, sure. A lot of things that occur in aging, a lot of the processes in the eye, the metabolic processes, and not just the eye, but the human body in general, undergo significant changes in aging. In particular, in the eye, long-term exposure to ultraviolet energy from light sources can lead to changes in the lens or the function of the retina. The more basic aging things that you'll see are the loss of the ability to focus on something up close. That's called presbyopia. So as we get older, it's harder for our focusing mechanisms to accommodate or zoom in on things that are close for multiple reasons. The lens hardens, the muscles responsible for focusing the lens weaken, and that leads to a condition called presbyopia. The other thing you see is the lens itself begins to harden with time, and that also makes it difficult and causes a change in the refractive or the focusing capacity of the lens. And then, of course, there's always issues like generalized changes in the arteries and capillaries of your body that not just affect your eyes, but your heart and peripheral circulation. They can also have effects on how the retina functions and the structure of the retina, and they can lead to disease processes like age-related macular degeneration.
Okay. And also, are we born with good or bad vision, or is it lifestyle driven, like watching TV or reading books under the cover at night?
Well, let's just say that under normal circumstances, a healthy baby with no obvious physical problems, underwent normal development, you're born with, let's just say, the capacity to see. Just like you're born with the capacity to read, or the capacity to speak, or the capacity to walk. Okay, but all of those require some training or exposure. If you don't learn to read at a young age, then it gets very difficult to learn to read as an adult. However, that cognitive ability of the brain is still there. It's more difficult to learn how to read, but you typically can still do it, as well as like speaking. As long as your hearing is intact, and vocal cords and cognitively you're intact, you still have to be exposed to a language, to be able to hear it, to be able to experience it in order to learn how to speak, okay? Visual system is like that, only it's a lot more sensitive. So the visual system develops very quickly, let's say, but it requires the interaction of the image and light to stimulate the nerve pathways that lead to vision. And you can take a child, well, you know, experimentally, you can take animals and take a perfectly normal animal. And if you deprive them of vision, let's say in the human eye, let's say you put a patch on one eye when the baby is born, and you don't allow that eye to see any light for a month or two, you can permanently damage the vision. In fact, most of our visual pathways are pretty much, as far as vision is concerned, pretty much completed by the time we're 4 or 5 years of age. And if you don't correct certain problems, visual problems, by the time a child reaches that age, it's almost impossible to recover the vision. It's very sensitive to development. You can take a child and put him in a dark cave for an extended period of time, and never a perfectly normal, structurally normal child, and put them in a cage for an extended period of time, and you could permanently damage their vision, because it requires that interaction between your visual world and your eye and your brain to develop vision. That process, if it's not corrected, leads to a condition called amblyopia in a child, which is a very common, unfortunately, a common problem we see that can be very easily treated. Essentially, it requires children to get screened in a timely fashion by the pediatricians or another eye professional to be able to detect it. Because even simple things like needing glasses or misalignment of the eyes can cause a child to develop amblyopia, which can later be very difficult to recover, even if you correct the underlying problem.
Kind of branching off to what you said about lifestyle, can extensive amounts of alcohol, smoking, or drugs have an effect on your vision?
Well, sure. For the same thing that, you know, like aging, I mean, all of it, both smoking and alcohol and drugs have been associated with increased frequencies and things like cataract or retinal disorders, cardiovascular disorders. Have direct effect on vision as well. Sure. Anything, especially if you're heavy drinking or drugged, if you neglect nutrition, which is also an important element in general health as well as eye health, if you neglect nutrition, it can also affect it indirectly as well.
So you mentioned nutrition being an important aspect of vision. And my mom is always preaching that carrots can improve your eyesight. Is this truly like a fact, or is this more of a myth?
Well, it's not so much that it can improve it. It's essential. The carrots and many vegetables and fruits and leafy vegetables and even things like dairy products, eggs, fish contain nutrients in particular, things like vitamin A, and that's typically what a parent is referring to when they say carrots can improve your vision. What it really says is that carrots contain a substance or pigments called carotenes, in particular one called beta carotene, which is a precursor to vitamin A. And vitamin A is essential because it's converted into retinal pigments that then are essential for your for healthy vision. The function of the retina relies very heavily on the presence of multiple pigments, both for the absorption of light, reflection of light, and so things like vitamin A, which you can get directly from animal, like fish and eggs, you can get essentially preformed vitamin A, but in the precursors that you get from vegetables and fruits have to be converted into vitamin A in your body through enzyme systems and things like that. And then they get incorporated in multiple layers of your retina, in particular, especially the photoreceptors, which are the ones that actually take, absorb the light and transform it into a light signal. So yeah, essentially, yeah, if you're, it's not just carrots, it's other things. That, I mean, there's other pigments that you can get from lots of fruits that are very important in visual function.
Great. So going back to TV, what role does screen time and blue light play in eye strain?
You know, that's always been a recent hot topic. And when I was growing up, it wasn't a big deal because most of us spent most of the time outside playing. TV or screen time wasn't a thing that we did. And the American Academy of Ophthalmology, our basic understanding of screen time and blue light exposure is not viewed in the same way as mainstream discussions about that. There is no proof, no verifiable scientific proof that blue light or screen time causes any permanent damage to your vision. In fact, we have essentially, I mean, we have pigments in our retina that are actually blue blockers, like you would see there's a yellow pigment in our retina, lutein and xanthan are yellow pigments that are heavily concentrated in your retina, especially in the central part of your retina, that essentially absorb blue light and act like blue blockers. They're basically a built-in blue blocking system in your retina. Now, there's certainly extended screen times or extended watching television or even extended the time reading or reading in the dark. That can cause eye strain for multiple reasons, but not particularly because of the light source or dim light. It's because it puts strain on the focusing mechanisms in your eye. It can cause your eyes to get dry because a lot of times people are sitting in front of the screen, they're like mesmerized. They don't blink. So your eyes get dry. That adds to strain, and the strain can lead to headaches. And there's a lot of those things that go around that are promoted. The optometrists have a firm belief. And there's other syndromes that have been kind of promoted, in particular, one's called Erlen phenomena, and it suggests that certain types of light can cause this visual strain syndrome, and they promote the use of certain colored lenses to block blue light or any other types of light, say pink lenses. And, you know, there's no real scientific evidence that those things actually work. However, there's no harm for the most part, and if has it been proven that blue light itself causes this issue? No, it's never been proven. Because a lot of the damage that goes on long term in your eye, in particular your retina, is caused by oxidants that are caused by the natural chemical processes that go in the metabolism in your retina. And a lot of the nutrients, a lot of the things like 3 omega oils and things like that, that act, a lot of the vitamins, vitamin E, that are act as antioxidants, those are the things that help protect you as well from the damaging effects of light rays.
Wonderful. So are there any early warning signs of serious eye diseases that people ignore? Or are there any symptoms that we should be taking notice of?
Well, yeah, sure, all the time. You know, and most of them is kind of common sense, or people just, like you said, choose to ignore them. Anytime you see that there's a sudden vision change, you should have them checked. I mean, anytime you experience blur, not being able to see something, or changes in your peripheral vision, severe pain in your eye, or light sensitivity to light sources, diminished ability to see in dimly lit spaces, flashing lights. Yeah, things floating around in your vision, floaters, double vision. All of those things can represent significant problems with your vision. It can be something very simple, but it can also be something very, very serious. And, you know, we recommend that you have your eyes checked, even if you're not having any symptoms, on a regular basis. I think one of the things that most often gets ignored more than anything is people who have a risk for something and then don't have it checked on a regular basis, in particular things like diabetes. Even though I didn't see it very much in my practice, I did have children who were type 1 diabetics. And usually type 1 diabetics don't develop the same diabetic eye problems that adult onset diabetes presents. And the changes that go on in your eye from the effects of diabetes can be very subtle at first. And if you don't get them checked, you may not even know they're going on until it's too late, or until it's advanced to a certain critical stage.
Okay. So now, moving on to the surgery part, we typically hear of cataract surgery, as you said, but what other surgery does an ophthalmic surgeon do? And which one's the most challenging?
Well, like I said earlier on, so you can perform corneal surgery with lasers, refractive surgery. You can do corneal transplants. You can do cataracts. You do glaucoma surgeries. And glaucoma is elevated pressure in the eye. There's ways to treat with like glaucoma when using lasers. There's valves that can be inserted in the eye that can help regulate the pressure inside the eye. Of course, there's retinal problems, not just the retina, but the vitreous is the gel-like substance that actually fills the eye from around the retina. Blood vessels can rupture and cause hemorrhages inside the eye. You can have retinal tears, retinal detachments. Of course, there's always injuries. People get injured all the time, penetrating injuries from objects, flying objects, sports-related injuries. And you can have, in my case, children essentially can get just about anything an adult can get. A lot of times the mechanisms are different, but children can get they can be born with corneal problems. They can be born with glaucoma. They can be born with cataract. They can be born with muscle imbalances. They can be tear duct problems, lid disorders, retinal problems. A large part of my practice was newborn eye disease. I essentially would treat newborn infants from the time they're born in the newborn nurseries for any potential eye problems. I spent a lot of time screening neonatal intensive care units in some of the hospitals in the Houston area for newborn eye diseases, because like I told you earlier, it's such a critical stage of visual development that you have to try to catch and diagnose and treat problems very, very early on to prevent long-term damage to vision. In particular, things like newborn cataracts have to be addressed very, very early in vision. Children who are born very, very prematurely can develop a vision-threatening retinal problems that over the course of time, we fortunately discovered it and have been successfully treating it. It's called retinopathy of prematurity. And we've been successfully treating it for many years now, most recently. For the longest time, we were treating it with laser. And then most recently, as in the case of things like age-related macular degeneration, we've been treating them with injections into the eye, with substances that prevent the development of certain abnormal blood vessels that can lead to retinal damage and loss of vision. So you have children. So in my case, I'd see pretty much the same things you see in adults, plus other things. Some things you didn't, but a lot of times the mechanisms are different. In particular, things like maternal infections, like rubella, measles, when a mother has infections when she's pregnant, can affect the children's eye or newborn's eyes. There's a lot of genetic syndromes are associated with things like cataracts or retinal disorders or corneal disorders.
So how would you diagnose when a patient needs surgery versus a non-surgical treatment?
Well, it just depends on the particular problem, but let's say cataract. And let's keep it in adults because it's a little easier. Children, you know, there's certain diagnostic and clinical parameters that you use to determine whether someone needs surgery or not. And children, a lot of times, you can diagnose a problem, and in many instances, you can try to treat it non-surgically. But then there's certain clear-cut cases where it's obvious that the child needs to have surgery. But let's say in a more common, a cataract. So as you get older in an adult, let's say your vision gets to be a little blurred and you go and then you get your eyes checked and the doctor says, well, you have early cataracts. And he says, you know, I can improve your vision with a pair of glasses. And that may be adequate enough for you, or we can perform surgery. Most of the time, surgery in that situation is almost determined by how much it's affecting your lifestyle. So just because you have a cataract, an early stage cataract, doesn't necessarily mean you need to have surgery. If you can still do the things you want to do, if you can read and drive and watch television and play golf or whatever it is that you like to do, then you can live with a cataract. A cataract is not life-threatening, and it doesn't necessarily, it won't permanently, except in a child, we're talking adult, it won't permanently generally affect your vision, because once the cataract is removed, typically your vision can be recovered. Okay. In children whose eyes are misaligned, and a lot of times you can correct them with glasses. You give them glasses, and because of the focusing mechanisms and how the eye's muscular function works, and a lot of times you put them in a pair of glasses, and then their eyes will go straight. Or a lot of times, if it's obvious that they don't have a significant need for glasses, and their eyes are crossed, and you try other simple techniques, like non-surgical techniques, like patching the eye, muscle exercises, and then you will try that for a certain period of time. And if they don't respond adequately, then you decide to do surgery. There's other things like retinal detachments or retinal tears that oftentimes, once you diagnose them, they need to have some kind of surgical procedure. A lot of times, in the case of small retinal tears or holes, you can use laser to treat them. So it doesn't require necessarily going in and cutting the eye open. Although large retinal tears or large retinal detachments almost always require surgery. Although sometimes they can be treated with air bubbles. I know that kind of sounds odd, but you can laser and inject air into the eye, and the air acts like it pushes on the retina and flattens it out and allows it to reattach to the surface of the eyes.
All right. So, now a fun one. What does a typical day in the OR look like for an ophthalmologist?
That's a very interesting question. And it really just depends on what kind of ophthalmology you practice. I can only speak from my experience. You know, generally, when we operate on a child, they have to be put to sleep. Again, generally, you can't operate on a child while they're awake. Now, a lot of adult surgeries are performed with the patient awake. Maybe they get some mild sedation or some topical anesthesia. But for the most part, children, you have to put them to sleep. For multiple reasons. So that requires general anesthesia. That in itself is it's a highly specialized field. Pediatric anesthesia also requires specialized training. And so it's very difficult to do 50 surgeries, pediatric surgeries in a day.
Oh, wow.
I mean, typically, it's by the time, even in my fastest operations, let's say I had to operate on two muscles, one muscle in each eye. Surgical time is 20 minutes, maybe, total. From the time the patient is draped and I start operating to the time we remove the drapes and the patient gets woken up, 20 minutes. But it takes about 20 minutes to put them to sleep and another 15, 20 minutes or 10, 5 minutes to wake them up. And then they have to move them to the post-op area for recovery. And then they have to come in and clean the room and change all the equipment and bring the next patient in. So on a good morning, I could do, starting at 7 in the morning, 10 cases. With two rooms.
Okay. Wow.
Well, that's not a lot. So I spend a lot of time. I get there 7 in the morning, say hello to my patient, talk to the parents, make sure they don't have any questions, talk to the anesthesiologist, go in, have my cup of coffee. It used to be read the newspaper, but not anymore. You look at something on your phone. You make some phone calls. You check your chart to make sure it's the correct patient, procedure's correct. And then you go in, do the surgery, and you come back, and then you sit around another 20 minutes while they get the next patient ready. Okay. So that's another cup of coffee, or you have a donut or something, and make some more phone calls, and then you do that. Refractive surgeons or adult cataract surgeons can do 50 cases in a day, you know, because they can do them in about 10 or 15 minutes apiece. So they can go very quickly. Now, that doesn't mean it's not delicate surgery or intricate surgery. This just means they're very good at it. And because now we have such modern techniques, that allow you to make very small incisions, remove the, you can pre-cut the capsule and you can pre-fragment the lens with the laser, and you can even make the incision with the laser. And you can just go in there and suck out the cataract lens, and then you can inject the foldable lens into the capsular bag, and you can be out, like I said, 5 minutes. So you could theoretically do, you can do, and there are many cataract surgeons that can do 50 cases a day.
Wow, wonderful. So now we're going to ask you two myth or fact questions. So first of all, there is a common misconception that rubbing your eyes too much can cause permanent damage. Is this a myth or is this a fact?
I've never heard that, Meredith. Who tells you these things?
I've actually heard it a lot within, maybe it's a younger generation thing, but I've heard it a lot.
You know, okay, let me just say that. I mean, we don't promote that thinking now. Rubbing your eyes can certainly do things to your eyes, but permanently damage your vision. You would have to really seriously injure your cornea, cause scarring. You'd have to maybe somehow increase, if you press hard enough, you could potentially occlude a central retinal artery, and you maybe, but it would require just some pretty aggressive rubbing. Just kind of like normal stuff, no. Now, it can cause other issues, eye infections, lid irritation, sometimes a condition, okay, that we used to see a lot. And that's, it's like an allergic conjunctivitis kind of, and you can get little calluses on the backside of your eyelid, giant papilla, they're called, like little cobblestones. And those little cobblestones, because you're blinking all the time, it kind of rubbing your eye, and they can cause long-term eye problems, you know, like scarring of the eye. So yeah, if you took sandpaper to your eye, you know, 3 or 4 times a day, yeah, you would scar your cornea and you'd lose vision.
So now for one of those common ones, does sitting too close to the TV really ruin your eyesight?
No, it's the same thing as the blue light. It can cause eye strain, but it won't, there's no evidence that it's going to permanently blind you, if that's what you mean.
That definitely makes me happy to hear.
Yeah, well, I'm sure parents say that all the time. It can give you a headache. It can, you know.
Yeah.
Right, that kind
maybe
of stuff.
Maybe I won't feel as guilty.
But why do you want to sit so close anyway? You know, most TVs, when I was a kid, the TVs were tiny, okay? Now you have like 50, 60-inch television screens. I mean, you can see it from the neighbor's backyard.
So what's been the most inspiring or rewarding part of your career?
This is the one wonderful thing about pediatric specialized physicians in general, not just pediatric ophthalmologists, is that most often a child will come in when they're young for whatever reasons, and they remain your patients forever. I mean, and you develop real relationships with them and with their families, and they learn to trust you and look forward to coming in. I can't tell you how many times a parent would say to me, she hates every doctor in the world except you. And when you hear something like that, that's really, when the child comes in and they're happy to see you and they're hugging you and the parents love you, they see you at the grocery store, and then you become part of their family, and then they grow up and they don't forget you and they still send you pictures, and they invite you to their graduations, they invite you to their weddings. So to me, aside from, you know, certainly helping people recover their vision, and certainly people are really grateful. And it's unfortunate that I wish there you could save everybody's vision, but that's not the case in ophthalmology or any profession. You can't always save the patient. Sometimes it's beyond your capacity as a human being to be able to do it. But when you can help them overcome the obstacles to functioning with their life challenges, then that's very important. I still have patients who, you know, that were severely visually impaired, but live very productive lives. And so that is the other side of it, is that it'd be really nice if we could restore everybody's vision. But it's unfortunate that we can't. And then what do we do with those individuals who still have real profound visual challenges? And that's why I'm involved with the work that they're doing over at the Texas School for the Blind. And because now that I'm not operating anymore and not seeing patients in an office, I want to try to promote and help develop tools that individuals who are visually challenged can utilize to lead productive, independent lives. And that's how I'm involved with the Texas School for the Blind.
And for the last question of today, do you have any tips or advice for anyone interested in joining the medical field?
Study, study, study. Get your sleep. Eat your vegetables. You know, it really is desire. And it's a long road looking at it from your perspective. You have to enjoy the process. You have to enjoy the journey. You have to enjoy learning. You have to be committed to learning everything all the time. It's like, I don't know, you guys take tests still, I'm sure. And you'll get to a point when you're in a science class or biology class or whatever class you think is boring. And you say, oh man, I just want to get by. You know, and I don't know how strict your parents are as far as grades are concerned, but my parents were very strict. You know, essentially anything in an A was unacceptable. Okay. And so I grew up with that kind of implanted in my brain, but I didn't always apply it in every class that I had. But once I got to medical school, you know, there's a process. You'll need your undergraduate, you got to do all your pre-med classes and et cetera. You got to keep your grade point average. You got to do well in the MCAS and interviews. So there's a lot of things that you'll do, you'll learn to do. But once you get into medical school, you have to enjoy it. You have to tell yourself, I want to learn everything. Why? Because it's all important. It's not like you can't. It's medicine is one of those things that it's not so much like zero tolerance, but you have to realize that someone is depending on you. And so that's what drives you to want to know every little detail. Now, does that mean that all of us know everything? No. I tell people this all the time. In my practice, in my world, is pretty simple. I just get up in the morning, and all I had to do with every patient that I came into my office, all I had to do is be honest and tell the truth. Meaning, if I knew something, I would tell. If I didn't know something, I would say so. But I always would say, I will find out, or I will find someone who does know. So as long as you're honest and you tell the truth and you're comfortable with not knowing everything and not thinking that you have to invent stuff, because if you admit that you don't know something, the patient's going to think you're a dummy. No, on the contrary. Patients appreciate your honesty. It's like, you have to say, yes, I know this, or no, I don't, but I will find out, or I know how to find out. And if I can't find out myself, I will find somebody who does know. And if you use that approach, you'll be very successful as a physician. And then the last thing is, you have to know yourself. You have to know what kind of person you are, what drives you, what you want out of not just your career, but out of your life, your lifestyle. Do you want a family? Do you want no family? You want to live at the hospital. Let's say a heart transplant doctors, they pretty much live at the hospital. Neurosurgeons live at the hospital. They're dedicated. They're type A personalities that just love it. They live there, they eat, breathe that, but it's very difficult, not impossible, very difficult to have a personal life. A lot of times that suffers. Ophthalmologists, we're more like, the laid back for multiple reasons. A lot of times we don't admit patients to our hospitals. Most of our surgeries are outpatient procedures, meaning patient comes in to get operated and goes home. A lot of these other specialties, like neurosurgery or heart surgery, or patients get admitted. You have to go in and do rounds in the morning. You have to see them. Emergency things that need to be. Ophthalmologists were a lot more clinic-based practices. So that means your evenings are usually free, your weekends are free, your most of our surgeries are elective. So that means you can schedule them, and it's a lot less demanding medical lifestyle, okay? Dermatologist, that's easy. It's important, but it's not like, again, very few dermatological emergencies, and you work 3 days a week, long weekends, make good money. So it just depends on what, if you want to be like, you could be a trauma surgeon. It just depends on what you want to do and what kind of lifestyle you want to lead. And that's where you have to know yourself. And I'll give you my example of that is that I did a surgical internship in Honolulu, Hawaii. And then I did a residency in emergency medicine in LA County. So my first specialty was emergency medicine. This was back in the day when emergency medicine was just evolving as a specialty, okay? And I trained in all the inner city hospitals in Los Angeles. A lot of violent trauma. I mean, horrendous gunshots, stabbings, you name it, drug overdoses. It was very, very serious environment. But you trained and you trained, and you came out pretty much bulletproof. So then I was working, and I'd always been intrigued by the eye, but I decided I wanted to, in emergency medicine, you do your shift and you go home. Nobody calls you, right? You work 3 or 4 shifts a week and you're done. You don't have to start up a practice. I mean, it's a lot of simplified things, but you're mostly like an employee. I became a partner in a group in California, and he was already 65 years old. He was a senior partner, and I was a young partner. I just made partner. And I was leaving after having worked an afternoon shift from like 2 to midnight, and he was coming in to relieve me. He was going to work the graveyard or late night shift, right? And so there's an old county hospital, really bad lighting, and it was kind of gave you this zombie kind of color to your skin. And he came in, like checked out the patients. I turned around to say goodnight to him, and here he is, 65 years old, my senior partner, and he looked like a zombie. And I said, no, that is not going to be me in 40 years, right? And so I went home that night and I told my wife, I'm going back to do a residency in ophthalmology. And she just lost it. She said, what? No way. Are you kidding me? We got 3 kids. We just bought this house. You can't go back. I said, I can't, because I can't keep doing this off this emergency medicine. It's not right for me. And so I, at the age of 40, I came back to do my ophthalmology residency, which is unheard of. It was almost unheard of. And I was very happy I did. So yeah, number one, you have to know yourself. You have to enjoy learning. You have to enjoy the journey. Don't get frustrated. Don't even think about how long it is. As long as you like learning, you're going to be fine.
Well, that was an amazing conversation, Dr. Gonzalez. Thank you. Thank you so much for being here today. We both have truly learned an incredible amount from your expertise. And that being said, this has been episode 10 of White Coast Real Talk, Beyond 2020. I'm your co-host, Atharva Anand.
And I'm your co-host, Akshara. And this is White Coast Real Talk. Thank you for listening.